listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kurula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host for the most, Nikki Kurula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We got two Mikes with us, Mike Elias and Mike Miller. How are you guys?
Very well, Nikhil. How are you?
It looks like you guys are almost spooning in the car. It's awesome.
We want to fit into your frame, man.
Hey, you got to get close and personal if you're going to be bandmates, right? This is how it goes. Right. So, Mike, well, I'll start with Mike Miller first. Mike, you and I recently met at a Songwriters in the Rounds. First, real quick, let's talk about Crossroads, Eric Clapton's music festival. We hung out the first day. Man, the second day was even more epic in a lot of ways. Tell me what your experience was, because I just was over the moon about it.
I mean, the first night was like beyond words, you know, like out of body experience with Judith Hill. Eric Giles, just, I mean, Gels, I think.
Eric Gels.
I mean, he came out screaming. I never heard of that guy before, and
he's so killer.
I'll be listening to him a lot more.
He's got a great record called The Crown, which I've been kind of following him since that record came out.
Nice.
And, I've met him twice, and he's just a burning player, dude. I think he's the modern day Jimi Hendrix. I don't think anybody plays like that, and he's just like ridiculous. So yeah, man. Yeah. And day two with Stevie Wonder singing with Clap. And then Santana, and it was just like, what is going on over here?
Right?
It was cool to hang with you on day one, and I was curious to see what you felt like day two.
Definitely.
Like. So, what was day two like for you?
Day two was I like day two better just because, let's see here, you had everything. You literally had every genre of music that you could think of,
right?
All playing guitar, and it just really showcasing the beauty of that instrument and how versatile it can be used.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Gustavo was great. I was blown away. I was, you know, the, I mean, Clapton, as Murray said, God.
Yeah. It's so
he
true.
Is God. And, and, you know, it was great to see Santana come out afterwards and throw down for like another hour. Like,
it was kind of funny too. Like, Bill Murray came out and was like, the show's not over. Like, people were starting to walk out. It's like, no, wait, there's one more. This Santana's playing. It's like, wow, I've never seen somebody have to like bring in people for Carlos Santana. You know, it's just kind of wild. It's so wild.
Yeah. And then it was cool because I almost think that kind of encouraged him to play longer because.
Right.
He gave us a hell of a set. That Love Supreme, oh my gosh.
That was wild, wasn't it?
With McLaughlin? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was crazy. Oh, you're lighting. You gotta hit your lighting guy. Wait a minute. Hold on, we gotta turn the car back. That's awesome.
Technical difficulties.
That's all right. So Mike Miller, I may just call you by your last names.
Elias Miller. That's probably easier. Yeah.
So Miller, you come from Sacramento, and you know, you kind of started playing music there first, then you kind of were always touring with the band, you played the Bitter End, you played some New York venues like Knitting Factory. Tell me, what was the moment of zen that made you want to become a musician?
Little difficulty again. Yeah, I'm having a little trouble hitting the, there we go.
You got me? Did you hear the question?
Yeah. All right, we're good now. Okay. I did not hear the question.
That's all right. I said,
it switched the car audio when I turned the car back on.
Okay, all right. No problem. So, Miller, when you originally came from Sacramento, you originally come from Sacramento. You've been touring and playing all over the country with a band before you started this new project. and you were playing venues like the Knitting Factory, the Bitter End. Tell me, like, what was the moment of zen that made you want to become a musician? Was it a family member that played you a song? Was it a family member that put a guitar or instrument in your hand? Was it a friend? What was the moment of zen that made you want to become a musician?
I mean, it's as clear as day, Nick. It literally was in 1997. It was in the spring, and Dave Matthews was becoming super popular.
Right.
And Ants Marching. It had to be 97.
No, 96. That was
95. Was
96
was... Okay. It's a spring of 96, because, yeah, it came out in 95, so my bad. Years are messed up. But the vision, it was Ants Marching. He was, like, playing the guitar, like, dancing, and he looked so happy, and I was just like, that's what I want in my life. I want to be that happy. And then it just kind of went on from there. But I can't say I don't come from a musical family. My uncle played, and my dad played guitar, and my grandfather played guitar around me. So I did have the experience of live music, you know, with my family as well. So nobody really...
What's cool about that is it's like you and I share that parallel. Like for me, it was 96, summer of 95, actually, was when I saw the Horde Festival. And it was Rusted Root, Lenny Kravitz, Dave Matthews Band, Blues Traveler. It was right around the time that Crash had come out. And what was so mind-blowing was hearing Dave Matthews Band after hearing those other great artists, and they just tore it up. And I felt the same thing. I was like, this guy's singing, playing, dancing. I want my life to look like that. And that's been what the factor was, too. So I love that we have that same parallel. We're bonded for life now. And Elias, you were an Elvis impersonator as a teenager. Tell me, what was your song of choice, and tell me, how did that come about? Because there's a movie in that just with that question alone.
Yeah. I don't know. I just felt like a very uncool kid. Like, all the girls that I liked didn't like me back. And at some point I realized that Elvis is like the coolest person who ever lived. So I was like, all right, I'll just snap this on and, you know, maybe just kind of learn something by osmosis. But no, I mean, I would do Hound Dog with like the 1956, like the white coat and the black rest of the outfit, you know, I performed, I actually lip synced it like while playing the record from the Ed Sullivan Show or whatever, or Milton Berle, out in the courtyard during lunchtime on like the last day of school freshman year. And it actually went way better than you would imagine for that kind of nerd fest. But yeah, like totally. That was
what I appreciate about. This then. You ready for this?
Yeah.
I've got to show you this. This is one of my favorite things. I'm a huge fan of flip books. I don't know if you can see this. Hold on. Look at this.
Oh, yeah. I can do that. If I weren't in a car, I would do that for you right now.
Dude, that's crazy. It's such a good dance move. I mean, as soon as I saw it, I was like, man, that needs to be like a staple of flipbooks nationwide. So you obviously studied Elvis, and you knew like so much about his life. So he was like the first person that made you want to become a musician. He was like the birth of cool for you, right?
Yeah, I think so. I just like was kind of a, you know, naive kid, and I don't remember what the moment was, but I just love his voice and his whole vibe, and he was a complete sweetheart of a guy. And a year or two just trying to absorb his style.
Have you ever been to Graceland or Sun Studio? Have you ever done any of those tours?
Actually, no, not yet. I don't have any family in the South. I've never really spent a lot of time in the South at all. So it's just kind of a weird, you know, weird coincidence. But someday
you must go. You have to go. I actually did a record in Sun Studio, and I first went to Graceland and went to Sun Studio, and they have one of the very microphones that Elvis used, and you get to like take a picture with it, and like it's actually on my cover of that record. But nobody uses it. They said, like, it's not a great ribbon mic. It's not one that we recommend to use in recordings. But sure. You can use all the other microphones. So I used a microphone that Bono and B.B. King used on When Love Comes to Town, which was just wild. But, like, it also made me really appreciate Elvis so much, because they give you the whole backstory of how, like, he went to Sun Studio to court a song for his mom, and that's how he got discovered. And it was the secretary, not Sam Phillips, who discovered him. So you must go to Graceland and Sun Studio because they're like very special places, and especially Sun Studio because it's like it looks almost identical to how Elvis walked into the building. It's still preserved. You can still see the ceiling caving in. It's pretty wild. So you being an Elvis impersonator, you definitely have to check out that place. And you can take your bandmate with you. You guys can tour through there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I've never been. So it is on my bucket list.
Well, you'll have to do a Memphis tour and get some barbecue nachos that will change your life. Yeah, yeah.
I've only played in Nashville. So, yeah, I definitely should.
You got to make that trip to Memphis to see the king, man, and see the king's place. So you guys, how did you guys meet and how did you guys start this music project that you guys are starting now, the Elias Miller Project?
We actually met at an open mic in La Crescenta. We're actually parked outside of it right now.
That's awesome.
Every Tuesday night. And I came for the first time myself about 2 months ago and didn't know anybody and just kind of saw all the acts. And Mike was by far my favorite. He just has this magnetism, this charisma,
this stage presence
that just blew the whole room away, like 2 or 3x what anybody else
achieved.
And later on in the night, you know, I'm mostly an electric guitar player, but I did an acoustic set. And then later on, Mike came and approached me and said that he liked my style and he thought we might work well together. So I was like, man, there's some real, you know, some cosmic, you know, organizing happening here. I'm gonna roll with this. And it's been great.
So what's the vision for the project? Are you guys kind of like still experimenting? Are you kind of like formulating like what the sound should be? Do you have an idea or a clear vision of what it should be?
We have a clear vision of what it's going to be. I would say right now the goal is for us to get really tight and that way once we approach other people, it'll be easier for them to just kind of fall in and add in their talent. But it's only two months been going, so we're still kind of new, you know. I think we've written maybe like 5 songs.
That's awesome. And so how does the co-writing process work for both of you? Do you come in with a song? Do you come in with riffs? Do you come in with a kind of like a open chords? Like how do you kind of do it?
It tends to be like a 75-25 kind of a thing where one of us will write most of it and the other will kind of fill in the gaps and maybe add a little flavor. But we're not married to that methodology. It's just what's been happening naturally so far. Yeah. I would say that most of it's been pretty organic, though. Like, there hasn't really been any kind of struggle. Like, we're still in the honeymoon phase, you know?
And Miller, you've been through the ringer with just being in a band and touring and how that kind of goes. I remember you and I talked and you were getting like interest from labels and you were getting like all kinds of things going. Tell me kind of like what a little bit of your path has been, because there's some beauty and some tragic events that have gone through that you and I both kind of have as parallels just being in bands. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was very blessed to meet a guy named Sal Valentino, and he really took me under his wing and he taught me some stuff. He is the singer of the Bo Brummels, an old act from back in the 50s, and then he did like Stone Ground and some other things. But he really just liked my sound and what I was doing and helped me kind of encourage me. I shouldn't say help me, but he encouraged me to hone in my craft. And so I ended up... Oops.
Technical difficulties.
We're good.
It's all right. So, I'll dim my light if it needs.
I eventually ended up moving up to the Pacific Northwest, and I ended up doing a West Coast tour from San Diego to Washington, Idaho, and Nevada, and Arizona.
Wow, that's a lot of touring. And that's not an easy amount of touring to hit all those states. You know, we all know it's expensive. It's time consuming. You're away from people you love. You know, it's exciting and it's a lot of fun, but it's also a grind and a lot of hard work that people kind of don't really value all the time. You know, it's like, even when you go to, you know, this feeling, like when you go to a city and people are like, hey, man, I don't think I'm going to be able to make it, even though for months I've been like, when are you coming to insert state here? You know, it's like kind of like the really biggest misnomer about touring is you think everybody's going to be available and just waiting, but that's not how it is in the beginning.
Nope.
So tell me about your touring experience. What was it like? How did you learn from it?
So that first tour, it was a big learning process. I had a home base in Eugene, Oregon at Oregon University. One of my old guitar players from a band that I had called Mike Miller and Friends, he was a student there. And so I basically crashed his dorm.
Awesome.
And so I would sleep there. I'd go up to like Portland, play a show, go up to Seattle, play a show, go all the way out to Idaho, play a show, come back. And then the other stuff, I'd either have to just kind of buy the cheapest motel I could get. That's money out of my pocket.
Right.
So sometimes I would just sleep in my car, you know, because that's just what you got to do sometimes. There's especially in LA.
You know what's so funny? It's like there are when you tour, you really, and this is definitely in the beginning, it's like you really get a smorgasbord of the cheapest motels across the country. And my joke with the Motel 6, for example, is such a luxury hotel in comparison to the Super 8 motels. I've stayed in those, I think, twice, and I'm like, never again. Everything is always wrong about the Super 8, and it's just like such a piece of shit hotel. And I've stayed in so many dreg hotels that to make that comparison, I'm like, oh, Motel 6. Oh yeah, I know the small towels and the little chalky soap. I'll take that any day over Super 8. And it's like you learn real quick the like shit hotels and motels you have to stay in just to make it work. And it's like even that people think they don't realize that's part of the journey that you learn. Like, oh, okay, this is what it takes to be a touring musician, so that, you know, you can make things, you can make the dollar stretch, and you can keep playing all over and just keep things moving. But God, I there's a part of me that's like, I don't miss some of those days for sure.
Let me give you one story of one of the hotels on that tour. It was actually here in LA. I was staying over on Sunset. It was like I think Safari Bungalows. Back when it was still open back in the day. Well, I was supposed to stay with my buddy, and I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to, you know, make him look bad. But he basically was like, yeah, you can stay at my place. But then he had a date, and the date went really well, and I couldn't stay at his place anymore. I'm like, dude, I'm from out of town, man. That's messed up. And I ended up getting such a bad sunburn because I went down to the beach just to play some songs and practice my set. And I got a really bad sunburn, so I had to get a hotel room for the AC. And, man, it was like going into like four – you've seen the movie Four Rooms?
Yes.
So literally, I literally thought there might be a dead hooker stuffed in my mattress. Like, the room smells so funny. And looked so shabby. I didn't even want to go under the covers. I literally turned the AC on blast and laid on top of the bed. That was it. I didn't even take I didn't go under the covers, nothing. I didn't move it. I was afraid to do anything other than just lay on top of that thing.
I hope you took the top cover off, because that's like the rule of thumb. You take the top cover off, and then you're kind of home free, at least, because they wash all that stuff. You know what I mean?
No, this is a 20-year-old Mike, so he didn't know that.
Well, I'm glad I just learned it.
You have to learn these little tricks that are like, oh, my God, that totally makes sense. And you learn it from usually veteran musicians. I had a veteran guitarist who was like, yo, rule number one, you take this top cover off because they never wash these, and they have to wash the sheets and the blankets. So those are usually clean. I was like, Interesting. So that's the first thing. Almost in any hotel now, I'm like, take that damn thing off. Just wing it across the room. So Elias, tell me about your music background and what city hotels you stayed in.
Man, I wish I could match that. But I come from a musical family, a classical music family. So I didn't even really start listening to rock and roll until I was a teenager. You know, kind of around the Elvis phase, and started playing guitar. Then I've really only been in like friendly jam bands and stuff, so I'm as fresh as they come. I haven't toured. I can count a one hand the amount of gigs I've played, so I'm the 35 year old baby in the car with, you know, the baby powder still on the behind. So I'm looking forward to learning all of this from a real.
You should make a documentary place. About your touring experience too.
you're welcome to. Sponsored by Motel 6.
What's funny is so I also come from classical music, and I studied opera as a kid, and also was singing professionally like that, and did it in college as well. So like the whole idea of touring in a band and going to these seedy places where you play, my very first gig, my parents are used to seeing me performing like really amazing, like Dorothy Chandler Pavilion and like all these amazing.
Oh, concerts. Wow.
So like my very first gig was at the Coconut Teaser on Sunset and Crest Nights. It's not there anymore. And it was at, the Crooked Bar. It was a little acoustic bar underneath. And I literally told my parents, I'm like, you're not coming to this. And they're like, no, why? I'm like, it's such a seedy place. Like, it's just not what you're going to expect coming from the world I just came from. And so they didn't come to that first gig. And what was so sweet, they were like, we don't care where you're playing. We're coming to the next gig no matter what. And they've been coming ever since. So it's really kind of amazing to see, like, that shift of like, you know, opera was never in fancy, like it was in like people's homes. That's how it started. It started with like these little house parties, and then it turned to having opera houses and all of that eventually. And what's really kind of crazy about rock and roll, it's like you start in these seedy clubs where you, whenever you can just get in through the door, and you just hope you can get a gig, and you're usually sandwiched with one metal band after another until you kind of find bands that sound like you, and then you can kind of like start kind of gravitating towards grouping bands together. But man, those early days, I mean, I can't even tell you how many metal bands we were lumped in with an acoustic set, you know, like in the middle of these heavy metal bands, because those are the only rooms you can get in. So, you know, Miller, you know what I'm talking about. Elias, you're about to find out. So tell me, like, you know, when you guys are creating songs, like, do you have bands that you share, like, influences from, or is it kind of completely like contrast and it has such differences that's what makes the combination work?
So funny enough, I actually wanted to be a Elvis impersonator as a teenager as well.
Awesome.
Right away we had that bond.
You lived the life I wanted.
my song was Teddy Bear, and I used to always sing it to this poor girl. Again, I won't say her name so I don't embarrass her. But my best friend, one of my best friends growing up, his mom's favorite memory was me singing Teddy Bear to her.
That's awesome. See, you were almost, you were on the brink of living your Elvis dreams, and then you meet somebody who is, he has toured and lived the American dream as the Elvis impersonator. And his Superman cape came in the shape of an Elvis outfit. Did you ever do the Vegas flip collar bejeweled outfit?
I always wanted to, but I was always doing it on a budget. And I never got paid. It was just something that I did because I was a nerd and enjoyed it.
That's awesome. So when you were in high school doing this?
I was. It was early on, too. I was like 14, 15, and there was like, you know, a year or two where I, you know, was just kind of honing that and making videos. And I actually met my wife online during that time.
That's
so
crazy.
So my wife has seen me be an Elvis impersonator as a 14-year-old and still married me. True love.
You know, you're like, you've seen me at my most gimmicky. Now you need to see me at my most glamorous.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Well, let's play something first. What do you want to play us first? What's the first song you want to play?
I think On My Own, because that's actually the song that we wrote together.
All right.
That was the first song that we ever wrote together.
Here's the Elias Miller Project with On My Own.
Say they're both the same. But if I go and tell our mama, just be sure to drop our name. God sent my little brother so I don't have to be on my own. Saved enough for today. God saved my little brother so I don't have to be on my own. Time there's disagreeing, always followed by relief. What you think and what you're being, when you gotta love me, don't believe. God sent my little brother so I don't have to try.
Cool, man. I like the riff. I like the vibe. Tell me what the inspiration behind the song and the style and the riff was.
So Mike came up with the original, like the first, and then I added the other riff on it. And I was at the time kind of angry at my actual little brother. So I wrote this song kind of reminiscing about childhood and appreciating him so that I would be less mad. And it totally worked. And that's just kind of how it came out.
And the lyrics are representative of that, or what are the lyrics?
Yeah, wow. They're sort of surrealist and not specific enough about anything that actually happened, but it's just, you know, warm sentiments and reflections on a happy childhood and just appreciating having someone who has the same memories as you for your whole life. And
that sounds like a very mature perspective. You can tell you're like seasoned in the life experience. You're like, I like don't want to be angry. I want to savor the experience. That's awesome. That's really awesome. And tell me, Mike, when you were coming up with the idea, did you have like a style in mind, or did it just come naturally? Like, what were you thinking when you were playing?
I've kind of been playing this like weird, like muted, choppy thing for like a while now, and I've just been trying to make a song with it, and it just kind of, I felt like it would, he could do something with it, and so I played it for him, and it just came together like right away. And then I told him, you should write words to this.
And did you record it? Like, did you use an iPhone to record it, or a computer? What did you use?
Yeah, we were recording it literally on an iPhone. And that's awesome. And I went back and I listened to it, and I was like, this is really good. You should do this. I was like, expand on this. And, you know, I think you should write some lyrics.
You know what? What's really interesting, you just made me think of this. So back in the day when I was rehearsing with my band in the early days, we only had, I think we had a tape recorder. That's all we had to record rehearsals. So all of our rehearsals in the early days was all on tape. And one of the tapes, fun fact, I ended up meeting Dave Matthews, and we met at the Sunset Marquee, and like I was like, hey, man, you know, I've got a band that I think you should hear. And he's like, okay, cool, man. You wanna come over and jam tomorrow? He literally said this. And I was like, yeah, man. And he's like, okay, 10 a.m. So I went back to the Sunset Marquee at 10 a.m. I'd never done a record with the band. And the only thing I had was, I think it was tape 3 of our rehearsals. It was the rehearsal number 3, tape 3. And we didn't make a copy of it because it was the only thing I had. Right. And so I went to the hotel, and I ended up waking up Dave Matthews in his hotel. And he was like, hey, man, he's like, man, I know it sounded like a great idea last night, but I went to bed at 8 a.m. And he's like, I'm super hungover. Like, can we reschedule? And my heart was breaking and shattering into a million pieces. But right. He's like, yo, man, did you, because I told him about, I was like, I'll leave you something. He's like, did you bring me anything? And I said, yeah, man, I just got a rehearsal tape. That's all I got. But you'll be able to hear, you know, what the potential of the band. So Dave Matthews has tape number 3 somewhere in his belongings. But it's those early recordings that honestly, they become invaluable. And I hope you never lose this recording because it'll show you how far you've gone. So the moral of the story is don't give your tape number 3 to any celebrity, no matter who it is. Don't give that demo to anybody and not have a copy backed up. So that you keep this demo as a way to show you where the song is heading as a reference. Okay, so remember that. That tip's on the house, all right? Well, what do you want to play?
I wish you would have given me that a long time ago.
Oh, man. there's so many. And like now it's like now I'm like 20 years into the game, and I'm still looking for those old, old, old demos.
Yeah.
Things, you know what I mean?
Right?
Because they become invaluable. They become, like, priceless, you know? So
yeah, it's a snapshot of where we were.
Yeah, yeah. So it's, like, one of these really cool things. Now you can record on your phone and you record it on your computer, and it's, like, so versatile and so easy. The theme song for the radio show I actually did on my iPad, and I was like, no touching instruments. See what you can create. And I'm like, man, I wish that I had this 20 years ago because this would be just mind-bogglingly cool to you know, use as a tool. So anyways, I love that you guys did this demo on your iPhone and it just came out so cool. What are you gonna play us next?
Hold on. So I wrote this song.
I was like, okay, I'll wait.
So the name of the song is Hold On. And I wrote this song literally in Miami on top of a roof right after Jam Cruise. And so I was really being influenced by Allman Brothers because I had just spent like an entire week with
Dwayne
Baylor Trucks.
Okay.
And so I had like a lot of Southern rock going in me and so this song came out of it. And Mike heard the song and really liked it. And I was like, well, let's do this song as one of our songs.
It tapped into his Elvis roots before Southern rock was Southern rock, right?
Right. Well, that's actually something that we have in common is Allman Brothers. So
I love, yeah, dude. Another. I love the Allman Brothers. They're such a big influence on me. I've got their box.
How could you not?
Look, their box set is right over here. That's it, right there. That's Dreams, right there.
Nice.
It's close by. It always has to be. All right, here's the Elias Miller Project with Hold On.
All right.
Hold on to what you
I love, dude. Not many people are influenced by Dave Matthews Band and the Allman Brothers. That's really
they right.
It's very crazy, but it's awesome because those are two of my favorite bands. Did you ever see the Allman Brothers live?
No.
What?
Yeah, what? No, I never. Did you?
No, I never got to see the Allman Brothers live.
You missed a great band live. One of my favorite bands.
Yeah.
I've seen them. I think I've seen them probably about 10 times. What really bummed me out is we actually played Bonnaroo in 2008. And the Allman Brothers were on the bill. And then Greg had to pull out because of his liver surgery because he had hepatitis. And so, like, I met Greg twice, once at an early Bonnaroo where we weren't playing, just to say thank you for writing the song Melissa, because that song changed my life. And the other song, you know, and then I met him again at his book signing. And, you know, I was like, hey, man, we covered One Way Out because you guys had to cancel. And he was like, cancel. He's like, I was getting my guts cut out. I was like, oh, okay, sore subject, shit. But, yeah, he was a very, like, tough person in some ways, but he was such a soulful dude, and I love the Allman Brothers, and I love that this song is emulating that style. Tell me, like, what the inspiration behind it was, lyrically or as a song together.
I mean, lyrically, it was literally just so, I mean, the hold on part was, I saw a lot of people lose their hats on the boat. So, just hold on to what you got, otherwise it might fly away. It was literally,
I had no idea.
Thinking about and then the rest of it is like, you know, it was my experience of getting on the boat. We all got on the boat 2x2. Like, if you have ever been on a cruise, it's exactly what happens. And that's your feeling is, you don't care where you're going. You just know you're going to have a great time. It doesn't matter. Like, I just need to get away, leave my troubles behind. And, you know, I'm going to hold on to what I got.
Make sure it doesn't kept your hat. I did. See? Elias, these are touring gems here. Hold on to your hat in case he gets flying away, right?
I'm remembering. I think there's going to be a Top Sheet Blues in the near future, man.
And coming from classical music, were you learning classical guitar?
No. No, I just kind of grew up around it. And no, I actually was introduced to rock and roll by my uncle, who was kind of like a rogue, you know, independent spirit of the family and did his own thing. And right when CD burners were becoming a thing, I had to tell him, hey, I can get your favorite songs on one CD for you. Just tell me what they are. And so he said, oh, man, he was really excited. And he gave me a list of songs. And on there was Beating Around the Bush by AC/DC. Mm-hmm. And I had never heard this song before. And the CD burner actually, like, glitched out and cut the song off about 30 seconds into it.
Oh.
But if you've heard that song or if you could play it, the first 30 seconds of Beating Around the Bush are just some of the best, you know, blues rock guitars I've still ever heard. And I just caught this as like a 14-year-old and was like, what is that?
Right.
And, you know, kind of became an AC/DC fan that way, and then took the blues exit off the highway to hell.
Yeah, the blues exit. I mean, I'm still going through that now. It's like, it started me in the beginning, and then, like, I kind of like went into the, you know, reggae world music jam band thing for a long time. And I'm back to the blues, and it's like, man, I don't know if I could ever leave. It's just such a great place to always kind of like reference music. I mean, it's just, it's always going to work. And there's always, I was just doing a jam with somebody that was just learning guitar earlier today, and we were jamming on blues. I'm like, this is such a pivotal informational entrance into the guitar to learn the blues and to feel like you're learning how to play the blues. It's just, it's everything. So I love that you and I have the same parallel from coming from classical music and getting exposed to rock and roll and blues music so late. So
can I ask your opinion on something?
Yeah.
I kind of got the impression like classical and blues are almost oppositely interpreted and like evaluated for quality. Because with classical, everything is pre-planned and pre-organized and pre-orchestrated. And there's an incredible amount of beauty you can get from that.
Yes.
But from what I can surmise, blues is so simple and so constrained into like very basic structures that what distinguishes good blues is what you can squeeze out of that, like what soul you can put into it and what you can wring out of this very kind of simple and constricted place.
Yes.
Feel about right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say also it's really about a language, understanding the language and what you can say within that language. So a guitar solo, it becomes like a language, you know? So like the blues has a structure that's very kind of like regimented in its form. And there's no improvisation on the form, but then there's a whole side of it that's all improvisation and it's got to be within the language. Like you don't hear a lot of jazz licks or kind of like, you can use country and bluegrass, but really blues has to be pentatonic using the scale, whereas classical music, it has very little room for improvisation. They call it ornamentation in classical music, as I'm sure you know. And it's usually when something's repeated, like they have the form. Mm-hmm. And then the second time when you do a piece, that's when you do the ornamentation. And it's not like a huge distance from the original. It's like a couple specific notes here and there that you ornament, versus blues, you kind of are composing and improvising on the spot. So you're absolutely right. They're two solid forms and regimented and rudimented. They're rudimentary in their form, but they're also super complex in how you express using that form. So I think there's a lot of parallels and differences, but that's what makes them so great. That's what makes music so great. It's like you would not have blues music without classical music. It just would not exist because the form of how music is put together is based on classical music theory, you know, especially from the Baroque period. So I can get all nerdy about it, but yeah, it's just like, I love all that stuff because it just offers so much insight into how music has evolved. You know what I mean? And one of the things I love about what you guys are doing with the duo, you guys are kind of like coming in fresh with like writing songs and like learning each other and how you can kind of like express the same vision, but coming from two different backgrounds. Like, how does it work as far as synergy or vision of the song? Do you talk about it beforehand, or you guys just play and you kind of like work it out as it's happening?
It seems like we kind of just fumble until we're happy with it. It's very kind of exploratory, and we're kind of, you know, just toddlers kind of bouncing in like in a common direction. And every now and then, you know, something we really like comes out of it, and we, you know, develop that or try it live and see how it goes. But we're really just still in the heavy experimentation phase and kind of liking how things are coming along so far.
That's awesome. Well, let's play something else. What are we going to play next?
It's called Mississippi Queen. And I wrote this song because I just have a big love for New Orleans. And I wanted to write
Mississippi part.
Yeah. I don't know why I went with Mississippi Queen. Turned out there's another song called Mississippi Queen. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I did hear that once before. So maybe subconsciously that was in my head, but it's not that song.
That's cool. So the New Orleans was an influence. Did you go there and you were kind of overwhelmed by the experience of it or what?
Oh, I'm a big lover of New Orleans.
Same.
Everything about it. I'd love to go to Jazz Fest. We should go sometime together.
Yeah,
a lot of fun. It's the same crowd pretty much that you get on Jam Cruise. So you see a lot of the same people. It's a great community.
That's awesome. And here's Elias Miller Project with Mississippi Queen.
Biggest boat that you ever seen. thing. Gonna make you, gonna make you scream. Getting funky on the Mississippi, Mississippi Queen. Mississippi.
Like you were getting a glass of water in the middle.
I had to scroll for the lyrics.
I was like, what happened there? There's something going on. There's a story behind this little pause right here. That's awesome. That's so awesome. You know, there's something like, it's like a spark. You know, it's like a lightning spark when you have those early demos and those early rehearsals. Those are still some of my favorite musical moments being in a band. It's like bringing a song in, rehearsing it for the first time. It's never better than those first moments. But it's like those kind of things that are awesome on demos. It's like,
right.
Oh, you're like, oh, yeah, we let it just keep going, you know, because.
Yeah, you know, it was funny. I forgot. And then as it was playing, I was like, oh, shoot, I forgot.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure you guys do this, too, where you like make a demo. And you're just like listening to the demo like nonstop. Like I love that feeling. In my last records, you know, I was doing a lot of piano tunes, which I don't usually do with the band. And I was like, you know, I want to do some piano tunes. And we started rehearsing. We just had this arrangement of one of the tunes. It's called Give and Forgive. And I just remember listening to it like 30 times in a night. And it's like, it's not the best demo, but it is the best demo because you just fall in love because you can see like the vision of the song. Tell me, like, when you guys are rehearsing and kind of working out tunes, like, when do you know you have the vision for the song to, like, put down the demo?
As soon as we start playing.
Right away?
Yeah, because magic's going to happen.
Yeah, that's cool.
I don't want to miss it. I don't want it to be missed. I will do stuff, like, on the fly. I'm really good at coming up with lyrics with ad-libbing it. And so if I'm not recording, I might say something really good that I want to keep for the song.
You miss it.
And then I won't remember it.
Do you make multiple versions of the same song?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
That's interesting. Oh, that's cool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
because yeah, I work the songs.
Yeah, it's like you almost don't know like what you're going to capture, which is cool about doing multiple versions. So then how do you know what's the final version of the demo?
I think we're still figuring that out. It's kind of like, I think a metaphor that we used early on was like, it's like pruning a plant. Like there's a seed, there's an idea that kind of grows and it wants to go in like 500 different directions. And then so narrowing it down to which ones we want to pursue, which ones we don't, and like which opportunities or possibilities creatively we want to cut off, and which ones we want to focus on. Like that's a maze that we're really just kind of exploring. And I think, you know, these are still pretty young as projects, and there's a lot of ways they could still develop because we haven't even, you know, jammed them with, you know, a larger band yet. We haven't invited people to contribute, you know, different instrumental parts to it, different vocal parts to it. And I think that could unlock a lot and kind of, you know, turn this seed into a tree. And there's just a lot of different ways it could happen.
Yeah, these songs are going to be organic. And they're going to change as soon as we add in a different element. And, I mean, stylistically it won't change because we're doing Southern rock. That's what we're going to be doing. So,
I think it's important, too. Like, when we started as an acoustic duo, like what you guys are doing. So we actually played shows for a year and just started piecing band members one by one to join the band. And it became like the acoustic duo thing became so tight because it was just the two of us. You know what I mean? So as we're adding people, we already had arrangements that now everybody could just, they would join so easily because the two of us were at the core of like being so tight so that everything around it could just join in and it would sound like one cohesive unit. So I think you guys are on the right track. What's next for you guys? Are you guys playing shows? Are you guys going to record a demo? Are you going to find more band members? Like, what's the next step for you guys? And I got to tell you, I've always done, you know, this whole radio show is about showcasing the creative flow of things. And I love that you guys are in this, like, infancy stage of this project because we don't get a lot of those perspectives, and they're so important when you're putting something together. So I love that you guys were guests and did it like this because it's really cool to showcase demos when people think that you need to hear it always finished. Sometimes there's magic in the demo that sometimes isn't in the recording because you played it so many times. So tell me what's next for you.
Well, we actually we have a show on Saturday. And then we're going to – it's in Pasadena at Cordova Bottling Shop.
Okay. Yeah, I know right where that is.
And then, like, you know, we're going to record some more demos. He's really good. He just actually recorded a new song today that we're going to start doing. What's the name of it?
Vain Philosophy.
Yeah, Vain Philosophy.
Nice.
So it's really good. And then, we're going to find some new other people to join in.
I love it.
Part of the family.
Yeah, there's so many jam sessions and musicians in this city. You have your pick to choose from, and you guys have cool arrangements and tunes. You guys already have a thing together, so it's awesome. Tell me a little bit about Vain Philosophy. What's the influence with that song?
Sure. So Vain Philosophy, in my last job, I worked in tech, and I wanted to build social networks that help people to find truth and find the world's best information on the internet more easily, because just, you know, that's kind of where the battleground is.
you know, information warfare and all that. So I've just kind of by necessity have been thinking about that a lot. And I'm tired of writing about epistemology. I'm tired of writing about philosophy. I want to be a musician. I'm a musician at heart. And so I wanted to write a song about epistemology. And instead of like lecturing people or writing a philosophy paper or something like that, I wanted to kind of embed this idea into a song. And it's really, it's really a reminder to myself not to try to figure out the whole world, not to try to come up with new philosophies and try to like improve on ancient wisdom, because it's just not going to happen. And, you know, the best thing for me to do, as I've realized lately, especially over the last year, as I've become a Catholic,
you're talking to the mic,
is
you keep turning your head.
I keep turning my head. Is the all the knowledge that we need to succeed as, you know, as individuals and as cultures, and you know there's no improving on it. There's no improving on morality. There's just practicing and valuing the wisdom that we already have. And that's something that I've, you know, been learning really hardcore recently. And I just wanted to write that song to say it from a heartfelt place to myself and everybody who might be, you know, struggling, like feeling like, especially the social media world is like America's next top philosopher. You have this competition of smart people trying to outsmart each other and be cool by being the smartest and like saying the edgiest, like new things. And there's just not actually any value in that. And I've been stuck in that trap and wasted a lot of hours and, you know, kind of hurt myself doing that. And I think a lot of people are, and they don't realize it. So that's what the song is about.
I love it. I love it. And that's a good place. We're gonna wrap up the interview. That was a great place to kind of leave it tied to a bow. Like, take it easy is how what I got from that, man. Just take it easy, bro. Take it easy, Mikes.
Well,
where can people find you? Do you guys have a website yet or anything like that? Not yet?
We have a SoundCloud. So if you look up the Elias Miller Project on SoundCloud, you can hear those demos, and we'll be putting more up. And, as time goes on, we're going to put some more professional recordings. We were actually talking about that today, putting up some more professional recordings. So, yeah, check out the SoundCloud, and as things develop, we'll post links to places where you can sign up for a newsletter or to a more solid website or to any releases that we put out on Spotify or anywhere else. Just kind of keep checking the SoundCloud until it happens, and then we'll be able to update people more easily.
Yeah. Love it. Guys, thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. We're going to have you back on once you start doing more records and doing more touring. On behalf of Mike Elias, Mike Miller, Sam, myself, thank you guys so much. We'll see you guys next week. Peace. Love.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence. Right here on LA Talk Radio.